Committee on Emergency Preparedness this May 1st. This is May Day, May Day, May Day, May Day, whatever that means. And I'd like to welcome everybody here. And we have a quick agenda today. We have several things that are going to conflict with us going out full time. One, the House representatives have to be back in the House by 4 o'clock. And so that's going to rush that. And we also have a full Ways and Means at 4:45. So, but it's the 4 o'clock deadline. But I want to try to get as much in as possible. And so I'm going to open the public hearing on House Bill 2814. And I'm going to call Brian, Representative Boquist, to the table. Also, Dr. Susan Allen. And Mr. Robert Money.
You can be the ombudsman.
Judith, do you want to pull a chair up and sit there and get ready, and we can kind of move around with the microphones as we need to? That'd be very good. And Representative Boquist, we'll start with you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. I think you have before you a dash one amendment, which I'm going to talk to very briefly. I'm going to talk to several things that passed out. One is the dash one amendment, which identifies.
Dave, excuse me, I should probably have Jim, for the benefit of everyone here, tell us what the bill does.
Yes, ma'am. House Bill 2814 appropriates money from the General Fund to the Department of Human Services for purchase of influenza or antiviral drugs, declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2007. You do have a dash one amendment, which would appropriate to the Department of Human Services $1,924,774 and add purchases of personal protective equipment for pandemic emergency responders. This bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
All right. Thank you very much. Now, Representative Boquist.
Thank you, Madam Speaker and Madam Chair. For the record, again, Brian Boquist, 23rd House District. The dash one amendment before you is some brainstorming on the behalf of EMS people, members of the committee, and I think Dr. Allen will even address it a little bit in her testimony, too. What our intent is to do is to be able to remind our colleagues in the basement, this is a policy committee, and of course I serve on two other policy committees, but remind our budgeteers that emergency preparedness in a pandemic is still something we need to do. It is a priority that we need to do, and we need to do it in a logical fashion. And the reason I raise that issue is I would remind you that the governor's budget, that there was $2 million in there for EMS trauma, which was cut out. It's not in the co-chair's budget. And $5 million in public health protection, which was cut out and is not in the budget. Which kind of leads us back at square one, exactly where most of us were about 4 months ago, before this session. And I recognize some of my colleagues that were in those meetings and saying we need to do more. And from a policy point of view, we can't appropriate money, but we can, in fact, send policy downstairs and say we need to address these issues. I do want to address a couple things on the amendment. The intent was to be able to identify emergency responders that would be used in a catastrophic disaster. And if you look on there, interestingly enough, when you start going down the list, you'll see some untraditional items that we discussed over the last 2 years. For example, emergency electrical and emergency utility workers. Who's going to keep the electricity running? Who's going to keep the power running? Who's going to keep the water running? And then what about the hospital staff, not just the first responders, but what about the hospital staff and the long-term care staff? You should also have with you a sheet of paper that looks like this right here, and I'll give you a little bit of background on that. It says Oregon Emergency Personnel Pandemic Response on there. What our office did, and interestingly enough, the good doctor's office has addressed this issue, and we're going to compare notes in the future because we're not very far apart, is if you look at that list, as we contacted the various agencies, sheriff's departments, fire departments, National Guard, health facilities, and said, how many people are required in a catastrophic emergency to provide the bare minimum support in such a disaster, in such a pandemic, and came up with a list across the state of Oregon that's required. The last thing I want to call to your attention and remind you of is a copy of an email And I'll identify this to you, and I'm not going to beat him up intentionally, because I think he's at least a friend of the dear doctor here, but I've had extended conversations over the last, since our last meeting with federal officials in Washington, D.C., in the CDC, and in fact in the regional director for Department of Health and Human Services. Some of the information I've gotten back from them has been their off-the-cuff thoughts on what the process ought to be, and you'll notice in the document I gave you that I was actually given a timeline that the federal government would come rescue us in 24 to 36 hours if there was a pandemic or another disaster. Upon more questioning of that, the actual written response is now 7 to 9 days for a partial rescue and 3 to 4 weeks for a full rescue. And I only remind you, and this, of course, is in writing here in front of you, is that I think the Secretary of Health and Human Services made the statement, we raised it in the last committee hearing, that if you're expecting the feds to come and rescue you, you're expecting wrong. What I'm asking the committee to do is to look at this from a policy issue. I've identified that there's a need out there. I'll be first one to tell you that, you know, I don't know what will happen when it goes down to ways and means. I would say that there are some areas of agreement and some areas of tweaking on the language, some minor tweaking that needs to be accomplished to put the dear doctor and myself at least in the same room. And we've worked closely together on this recently, and I think we can work together once it leaves this committee downstairs to come up with the appropriate language to help protect Oregonians. And with that, I think I'm going to turn it over to the doctor.
For the record, I'm Dr. Susan Allen, the State Public Health Director. Is the mic working? I think it is. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to come back and talk a little more about the revisions and the ongoing conversations that Representative Boquist and I have been having on this issue. As you know, this is not in the governor's recommended budget, and therefore I'm not in a position to actively support it. At the same time, there are many very real needs out there that are being identified, and the issues are being raised in the discussions leading to this proposal, and I would like to make some comments on the nature of the needs and how some of those needs might be met to the betterment of the people of Oregon. It is quite true that the state is underprepared for health and medical emergencies in too many ways. Too many of our communities are stretched thin, don't have the supplies, don't have the training, are not currently ready to respond to the types of emergencies that you might expect to hit them. I appreciate in this revision the effort to broaden it just beyond pandemic influenza. My concern is very real about preparing for pandemics, but also to know that there are many other types of emergencies that could hit a smaller community, not necessarily the whole state, also with significant or potentially devastating impact. And I'm looking for the ability to have flexibility to do what's needed for the individual communities, the individual agencies, the individual responders. So in the Portland metropolitan area, the hospitals are well staffed, and in many parts of the state, but perhaps not all. Currently, our local health department in Klamath County is struggling with an outbreak of tuberculosis in the area, and their very small department doesn't currently have the staffing and the medications on hand and the other medical supplies on hand, which includes masks and gloves and so on, even to be able to address an outbreak of tuberculosis in that community. So I do believe that that anything that we could put to providing a supply that could be deployed in communities as needed to expand, meet their needs and expand their ability to protect people would be of value. And I look forward to working further with Representative Boquist to be able to identify the kind of language that would allow the communities to be supported in the needs that each individual community might most benefit from. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Allen. Mr. Monahan?
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Robert Monahan. Just as a background, I'm a retired military officer in special operations. I've worked in civil affairs for a number of years, and I've participated in humanitarian operations, as well as planned them globally for natural disaster and evacuation of American citizens and allies out of troubled areas. I've also had a healthcare career background. I started off with American Hospital Supply, so I've come from medical diagnostics and a biotech background, and I'm neutral on this bill. I don't have any specific interest one way or the other, but I thought what I would do is just represent maybe a business perspective on this, playing on my background. You've probably heard a lot about pandemics, and the particular one everybody's concerned about is the avian flu. And why is it of concern? Because it jumps species and is carried by migratory birds. So there's no way to stop a pandemic from spreading if it's an avian virus from country to country. So you can't close a border. You can't do it. You have to shoot all the birds down. And at that point, I think it's just like shooting ducks. It's a measure of fertility to get them all. The other part of it is that if you're going to produce a vaccine, vaccines are typically produced in eggs and will be for the foreseeable future until the new genetic models come on board. That's compounded by the problem that we don't know whether the vaccines will work for or against the host that's taking. So, for example, if I have the avian flu and I take a vaccine, is it going to be effective or is it going to cause another problem? You've seen that many times with, like, the Hong Kong flu outbreak where everybody was inoculated and yet everybody got the flu because the vaccine didn't cover the virus strain on it. And looking at it from business, this really is a management issue. And whether you call management government or you call it a business, this is what we're here today to debate. And I think the issue on it is that we really don't know how to prepare for this specific pandemic. We do know that a pandemic will be here. It's not a question if it will be, but when it will happen. To go ahead and buy a lot of viral drugs and buy other equipment, there's a balance that goes in there. And if you look at the preparation opportunities that we looked at in the business community, is that we felt that you need to have in a general support first responder training and preparation with personal protection gear.
Madam Chair, I'm still trying to figure out where you're from.
From Washington County.
Okay. I didn't hear you say that you were from Oregon or you were from Washington, D.C.
My apologies. I'm from Oregon.
Okay. You're a local business person.
Yes.
Right? Okay. And you've had, I understand your background, which is very good. Okay. Just thank you, because I needed to ask that question.
I apologize. I should have said that. I'm sorry. I wrote it down on the speaker list, but failed to mention
okay,
that.
Okay, thank you.
And I have appeared before you, just for your information, that I'm the interim director of ATRADI, which is the Infectious Disease Institute, but that's not why I'm here today. Just to clear that, that's a separate thing in drug discovery. But I'm here just to talk about the business issues that relate to large corporations and try and share some of the experiences and the background we had on that. And the large corporation I was just with recently was Sigma Aldrich Corporation in St. Louis, and we did a lot of pandemic. We felt that government would not be there to help us, okay? And the reason for it is government's not prepared. So the federal government is not going to be able to help you in the first wave. And pandemics come in waves. There's usually 2 to 3 waves, and there's no reason to believe that we won't have a similar occurrence with the next pandemic. So in that case, what do we need to do from a business to ensure that we have continuity? And the continuity means how do you protect the employees, their families, how do you do telecommunications, how do you operate a company, how do you still supply? And that's compounded by the problem that we're a just-in-time economy. And when you look at it as just-in-time economy, and if I'm a seafood producer, there's no way I'm going to ship my seafood to market because the transportation system shut down. All right? There may be border problems, public safety is going to be affected, and so on. So I need to look at it from a personal security standpoint for our families and employees, as well as the continuity operation of the business. When you go one layer up from that, you now look at your public services, and that's where the debate comes in. You need to have some rules of order. So you have to have your first responders, because you're going to overwhelm your healthcare system. And when you overwhelm your healthcare system, that means your police, your fire, your public services people, all of those are going to be impacted either directly by illness or illness within their family. And so there has to be a precautionary step as to how do we do that. What we've done in business is we bought a limited amount of Tamiflu, for key personnel to do it. We couldn't have enough for everybody. It outdates, and we didn't have a vaccine. So that was what the recommendation from the CDC was. And we based that on that we're at a level 3 pandemic, and that means there's been no to limited transmission of virus, in particularly in the avian area, and there's been about 288 cases of it worldwide as of April of it, since 2004, and 170 have died, but they've died principally in China, Indonesia, and Vietnam, and those are Egypt. And those are places, if you've ever been to a country that's struggling to upgrade, they have no healthcare services. You know, they're drinking water that has sewage and everything else in it, and their immune systems are very weak. So the recommendation that we made for business is that we needed to support our local fire departments and first responders with the local city governments, because that's where it's all going to take place. So if you live in the city of Salem, Salem's where your production's going to come from. And if you lived in Tigard, it'd come from the Beaverton Police Force. That's where you're going to get it in fire, Walton Valley Fire Rescue. So our recommendation was to do personal protection gear, have the simple things for not only supporting against the pandemic, but also for other illnesses. Because remember, just because the pandemic is here, that doesn't mean that people don't get appendicitis, break legs, get colds, do all the other things. And the important thing is to have a network out there that can triage that to put the people in the right bucket to give them the help.
Thank you very much. All right, Judith.
Chair Verger, members of the committee, on behalf of Oregon Health and Science University, I'm here to testify on House Bill 2814. My name is Dr. Judith Guzman-Cottrell. I'm a pediatric infectious disease specialist at the university. I am also the OHSU hospital epidemiologist for the Children's Hospital, and I also serve on the Emergency Preparedness Committee for the University Hospital and Clinics. And we've been doing pandemic influenza preparedness for our own university for about 2 years now. In general, I am in support of a bill that increases funding for pandemic and emergency preparedness in the state of Oregon. However, I am neutral, testifying as neutral on this bill. Based on calculations and anticipating an approximate 25% attack rate of a pandemic influenza strain, OHSU would experience a 20% increase in hospital admissions, which would equal approximately 800 patient admissions over 30 days. And as was mentioned, this comes in waves. So this would cause an enormous amount of stress on our university and clinics. Among other systems, it would affect hospital communications, the infection control program, emergency healthcare worker training, occupational health to perform surveillance of its potentially exposed and sick healthcare workers, counseling for employees, employee child care with daycare and school closures, pharmacy supplies, medical supplies, lack of patient bed and ventilators, security and mortuary issues. So as been previously mentioned, there's going to be a lot of things that are tasked in this type of a situation. As you know, House Bill 2814 focuses on the purchase of vaccine, personal protective equipment, sanitation supplies, and antiviral medications. My concerns, which are reflected in the infection control program of OHSU, are, as you know, the pandemic influenza vaccine is currently unavailable. It's not something that can be made ahead of time. And also, although most infectious disease specialists like myself believe that pandemic influenza is inevitable, we just don't know, and the key question is, when is it going to happen? And if we were to spend a large sum of money on antiviral medications, as you know, the shelf life of these medications is 4 to 5 years, depending on when you receive them after manufacturing. And if that pandemic didn't occur within the next 4 to 5 years, then that would be money lost. For these reasons, I think it's most reasonable that no timeline or deadline be established regarding spending of any money related to this House bill. As the timing of pandemic is uncertain, statewide pandemic planning also is multifaceted and a continuous process, which may occur over several years until the pandemic does occur. My thoughts regarding additional funding considerations, rather than having a very strict list of what we could spend the money on, would include the following. To improve strategies to track possible novel virus strains or enhance surveillance of the influenza strains that we see every year. to ensure adequate supply for materials needed to diagnose influenza rapidly in hospitals and clinics, i.e. rapid influenza testing, so that we could identify patients who are sick or exposed and have become ill, and then put them in the appropriate isolation. Development of standardized practice education materials for healthcare workers. So I'd really like to focus in the next upcoming years until the pandemic does occur on preparing healthcare workers, the emergency responders, with education and even mandatory education. To test and evaluate systems and response capacity regularly through exercises with healthcare facilities, public health, and emergency management agencies. As you know, there was a statewide pandemic influenza drill in November of 2006, and our university did participate in that drill, and we learned a lot in that drill as far as what we needed to improve on as far as emergency preparedness and response. And then to test and evaluate national protocols for conducting mass vaccination distribution campaigns. And we could do this every year using just our regular annual influenza vaccine. We could test and see how these vaccine strategies, getting the vaccines into healthcare workers and first responders, would occur. And then we could give feedback to different hospitals, clinics, et cetera, on how they did on these mass vaccination practice strategies. In summary, I'm in full support of a bill that does increase funding for statewide pandemic and emergency preparedness. However, the bill should not be restrictive in how the funds are utilized. This should be determined by experts in the field of pandemic planning, emergency planning, and surge capacity. In addition, there should not be a specific timeline stated as far as when these funds would be spent, since the timing of a pandemic is so uncertain. Thank you for your opportunity to testify today, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Judith. I'm going to go back to Representative Boquist. I did not know about the one-hour timeline for this committee, and we have people who have come back for the second time for one of our bills, and we have another bill waiting. And I don't want to rush through without lots of questions and discussion, so what would you suggest, Representative Boquist?
Madam Chair, I know amongst the group here we've spoken quite a bit and kind of determined our course of action was to try to go downstairs to Ways and Means, take it from a policy perspective that we need to do more, and then go downstairs to Ways and Means and tweak the language in concert with committee members here and with Dr. Allen and the experts and come up with language that benefits the entire state. I would comment on two things. One, of course, it's a biennium period, so there is not a timeline. Of course, we have to spend the money in the biennium. And as we all know, none of us are confident whatever number we send downstairs, that's the number that will or if comes out downstairs. I think the bottom line is we're far enough in the process that we need to, in my opinion, need to put something downstairs in Ways and Means as a placeholder for a discussion. And I think the simple question we have to ask ourselves is that where is the state of Oregon in planning? The good doctor, and I pointed out, would agree that there was originally in the governor's budget $2 million for EMS trauma and $5 million for public health protection. There's zero now, which puts Oregon pretty much zero at the bottom. And the discussion now is implementation types of information and how to tweak a bill downstairs for that and a placeholder in Ways and Means. My request to the committee, Madam Chair, would be to move the Dash 1 amendment and the bill downstairs and allow the three of us that are sitting here to go downstairs and have that discussion in that committee.
Well, I would like to have the committee have an opportunity to question both you and Dr. Allen, and I'm just wondering, in order to do that, if you'd be willing to come back next week, and so that the committee could have an opportunity to question you and have a further discussion on the pandemic. And so with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2814. And I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 790, and I'm going to welcome Senator Decker to the podium. And Representative Green, are you going to join?
No, I'm going to stay right here.
All right.
Okay. Unless you want to go.
Wherever you're comfortable.
Welcome, Senator Decker. You'll introduce yourself, and I'll have Jim tell us a little bit about the bill.
Senate Bill 790, places moratorium on leasing for purposes of exploration, development, or production of oil, gas, or sulfur in territorial seas, excludes exploration for scientific or academic research purposes or geologic survey activities, requires that exploration for oil, gas, or sulfur in territorial seas conform to standards of the Oregon Ocean Resources Management Program sunsets January 2nd, 2012, and there are amendments.
Senator Deckert, I thought that we had put in an amendment about a moratorium, and I don't have that amendment. Do you? There we go. Okay, very good. Very good. Okay. Well, she just has dash twos.
I think those are the ones.
Doesn't have anything about the moratorium. But tell us a little. Introduce yourself and tell us why you brought this bill.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, Madam Co-Chairs, and you've heard from me on this, so I might turn it over to Co-Chair Boone, other than to say that the Dash 2, we worked with your office, Madam Chair, on the Dash 2s. I do feel fine with moving that sunset date up to 2010 and having a moratorium on oil drilling through 2010 and allows the next legislature to come back and I think many of the comments that Senator George, Gary George in this case, made were actually very good ones. We don't know where the technology is going to lead us. We don't know what new options may be out there, so let's shorten up the sunset a bit. But given the current state of affairs, I still think adopting the Dash 2s and moving the bill is a very good idea. And with that, I might turn it over to the good representative from Cannon Beach.
All right. Thank you. Thank you. And for the record, Deborah Boone, House District 32. And I co-sponsored this bill with Senator Deckert for several reasons, but one is that our governor has signed a tri-state compact with California and Washington, and one of the purposes that they have outlined in that contract is to hold off on oil and gas drilling as it might affect fisheries and, what we're trying to do with wave power, et cetera, in our state. Sorry, I can't move from side to side. I could swivel.
All right. Madam Chair? Madam Chair. Representative Shaw.
Man, I'm looking all the time.
Madam Chair, thank you. I just wanted to get a few things on the record here. I recognize the fact that Oregon Coast is arguably the most beautiful place in the world. I've been all over the world, and it is. And I think you can easily argue that. And I will be supporting this bill today. But I just, and it's out of respect for the sponsors as much as anything. But I just, we've wrapped up a lot of natural resources in this country. And I think it's to our detriment. And with the advancements, and we did it for good reasons, I think, in the first place. Because of the destruction and our lack of conscience, the lack of what we were doing at the time. But as knowledge and technology and our willingness to work sustainably with the environment, my advances, I'm glad you've changed the sunset on this, because I don't want my daughter's world dependent on foreign oil or foreign energy. And I think, we have, whether we use the word moratorium or not, we have moratorium on water, on soil, on timber, on mining, and many areas of the statute. And I'm not saying all of that's necessarily bad, but I think we painted ourselves in a corner, not in this, just in this state, but in this country. And we need to start taking a good, hard look on how we use our water and our timber and how we don't use it. Much to the detriment, in my opinion, of this state, especially in light of the fact when we're scratching and clawing and begging for nickels and dimes, when this state is abundant and rich in natural resources, and we have an army of people that know what to do with it, in my mind, in an environmental and economically sustainable fashion. So I will be supporting this today, but if I'm still in this building in 2011, I'm not promising I'll support it then, especially in light of the advances in technology, directional drilling, a lot of things that I don't know anything about. So thank you for indulging me, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative Shelfler. Other comments? I'm pleased with the dash two amendments. In glancing over, I missed section B, which is the section that I was very interested in, and that is that it would not apply in the event that we had an oil embargo against us and were ourselves desperate for some kind of assistance. So,
and Madam Chair, if I might just add, I did mention wave energy or wave power, but I think that is, at least in my opinion, a good enough reason to do this, because I would rather focus on wave power at this point than more oil and gas.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you very much, Representative Boone. All right. I would entertain I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 790, and I will open a work session on Senate Bill 790, and I would entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, I move the dash two amendments to Senate Bill 790.
Representative Nelson moves the dash two amendment to Senate Bill 790. Is there any discussion?
I'm sure I agree very strongly with Representative Shoffer's comments, and those of us that are from the coast, I've been there since I was three years old in Seaside in 1943, and I've seen some changes I don't like. I think we need to protect it the best we can, but if technology does give us ways to utilize things, I think we're foolish not to do that in the future, but we have to be careful.
Thank you. Any other comments? Any objections? No? So moved. Representative Nelson.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 790 as amended with the dash two amendments to the
To the floor.
To the Senate?
It's to the floor.
Period. Okay. To the floor with the new
pass
recommendation.
All right. Representative Nelson moves the Senate Bill 790 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Madam Chair.
Just Senator George.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I understand the intent on 790, and I got to tell you what Representative Shoffer said is so true. I'm going to vote no on this bill, and mainly today's our discussion on the Senate floor was about the war in Iraq. And the fact is that we have become dependent on foreign oil. And for whatever we view the war in Iraq about, the fact is that we pay special attention to these hot spots in the world because of our dependence on foreign energy. And I just hate to see us sit here and preclude things. I know in Central Oregon we've precluded a great geothermal plant from siting because of land use laws, and we have all these opportunities that we miss. And I don't know what the opportunities are that we're missing with Senate Bill 790. And I guess from my perspective, I understand where the sponsors are trying to go with it, and I respect it. At the same time, at this point, we just are shutting down so many opportunities that this state has for renewable energies and opportunities for our own sources of electricity and power, and I just am not going to be able to support the bill, and I just want to explain my position real quickly.
Thank you, Senator George. Any other comments? I'll ask the clerk to call the roll.
Senator George Yell?
No.
Senator Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Senator Morissette?
Aye.
Representative Shoffler?
Aye.
Representative Cowan?
Aye.
Senator George G?
No.
Representative Nelson?
Aye.
Representative Boone?
Aye.
Chair Berger?
Aye. All right. The Senate Bill 790, with the votes needed, has passed. Congratulations to the carrier. I need a carrier for the bill.
Four.
All right, Senator Decker will carry the
on the mic.
All right, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3541.
Madam Chair, members, House Bill 3541. If you remember, this is a committee bill that we got a special permission to file as a committee bill coming as a recommendation from the Coastal Caucus. It would reduce the number of permit renewals from 1,200 down to 1,000 for a determination when the Department of Fish and Wildlife shall issue permits by lottery system for the Ocean Patrol salmon fishery. It establishes categories of vessels by size and corresponding fees for permits issued under the lottery system. It specifies that when a vessel in one category does not renew its permit, only a vessel in the same size category or smaller may qualify for that permit. We have a no revenue impact. We're still waiting on the fiscal. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Judith. I'll call Roy Elliker and Kurt Melcher.
Ready to spring forward.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and co-chairs, members of the committee. Appreciate the opportunity here to testify. My name is Roy Elliker. I'm the Deputy Director for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. On my right, Mr. Kurt Melcher, our Administrator of the Marine and Coastal Interjurisdictional Programs, and also actually our key representative at the Pacific Fishery Management Council. So Kurt and I today have some brief prepared remarks, and I know in view of the time we'll move right through these, Senator Berger, and let you get back to the floor for the House members. We have worked with the Troll Salmon Commission on this bill. The Department, frankly, doesn't have any problem with this reduction. Just reminding some of the members that commercial salmon fishing regulations are set annually by the Pacific Fishery Management Council for 300 to 200 miles offshore, set in state waters by the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission. From 2000 to 2006, Oregon trawlers have landed an average of 2.6 million pounds of salmon per year, with an ex vessel value of $11.7 million per year. So it is an important commercial fishery, not near the size it used to be, but certainly still very important to our coastal community. Since 2000, the average number of permits that had salmon landings was only 475, and last year only 358. So there is a reduced number of active folks in the fishery, reducing the total lottery size from 1,200 to 1,000. Does not look like to be a substantial impact as far as the agency is concerned. We have a little attachment that gives more detail about the commercial troll fishery. I'll let Kurt make a couple points from that I think that it would be useful for the committee to know, and then Madam Chair and Chairs, we're ready for questions.
Thanks, Madam Chair, Co-Chair. As Roy mentioned, my name is Kurt Melcher. I'm one of the Assistant Fish Division Administrators. I will be very brief here in light of the time. As Mr. Elliker mentioned, the fisheries off the Oregon coast are managed jointly between the federal agencies, Pacific Fishery Management Council, and the State Fish and Wildlife Commission. The commercial salmon fleet is extremely diverse. It includes a range of vessels in size from less than 20 feet to vessels in excess of 50 feet. The troll salmon fishery is a hook-and-line fishery whereby essentially lures or baits are trolled through the water column and salmon bite, essentially, and are landed. The catch is all processed at sea by the fishermen and landed fresh to local buyers on the coast. Just some very brief history. The fishery really began to develop by about 1912. By 1919, there was up to a couple thousand vessels trolling in the ocean. By 1980, there was over 4,000 vessels participating in the ocean commercial salmon troll fishery off Oregon each year. And in 1980, the legislature adopted a moratorium on new permits and capped the number basically grandfathered in all the existing permit holders and instituted a lottery provision whereby new permits would only be issued if the number of renewals fell below 2,400. That was in 1980. Since that time, there has been several additional reductions in that lottery cap down to the current level of 1,200 renewals. And on the back page of the attachment, there's a table that shows the number of troll permits that have been renewed annually since 1989, as well as the number of vessels that actually had catch in any of those years. And then the same information is displayed graphically to illustrate somewhat where we've been, both with regard to the number of permits that were renewed, the number of permits that actually made landings, as well as the cap that was in place in statute. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
All right. Any questions for these two gentlemen?
I just have one, Madam
Chair. All right. Representative Nelson.
Yes, thank you. On page one of your letter, or of your speech, the very last line will say, it says, but will help prevent new capitalization in the fishery. Could you tell me what you mean?
Sure. Thank you, Madam Co-chairs, I guess is a proper way to refer to you, and Representative Nelson. In the world of commercial fisheries, essentially, capitalization is where we have new vessels, larger vessels in particular, coming and entering into a fishery that essentially leads to less opportunity for the current participants. And so the statute that's currently in place has a basically some size categories where permits can only be transferred to vessels of a similar size. And that's an effort to prevent overcapitalization. In other words, much more catch capacity being built into the fishery with the same number of active participants. And it was an attempt, I believe, by the legislature also to maintain some historic distribution of vessel size amongst the fleet. So that's what we're referring to there.
Follow up, Representative Nelson?
I'm good.
All right, you're through.
Representative Krieger.
He's
wasn't
been
in
first.
Line. Sorry, Representative Nelson.
Roy, could you comment at all what I think will take place? Last week, California created 129 marine reserves, some of that on some pretty good fishing grounds, as to whether this might, as often happens, cause effort shift out of California.
Well, Representative Krieger, I think that that's certainly a possibility as these fisheries and the fishers that take place off Oregon, Washington, California are many many of the same individuals. They hold permits in all those states, and they do transit back and forth to fisheries off other states. And so in any time that there's a restriction of opportunity in one state, it can lead to additional effort in another state, or perhaps even more great than that is the effort shift within the state.
Okay. Follow up? I think historically, when there's an abundance of salmon, you see people come back into the fishery and take advantage of that. And I just want to make sure people understood that if you want it to be sustainable and that the individual fisherman is sustained, because if you're dividing up a pie, and the more people in the pie, the less the shares are. So I think by reducing these numbers, it will make those that stay in the fishery and really want to be a salmon choler have an opportunity to be more viable. And probably had there been this knowledge of the thing was going to take place in California, maybe we should have went to 800. But I'm perfectly satisfied with the bill now, but we have to understand what happens in other states is going to affect Oregon.
Thank you, Representative. I'm going to get you to step back. We have two more people to quickly testify, and this is our committee bill, committee members, so I'm going to call Nancy Fitzpatrick and Carl Finley.
Thank you, Co-Chairs Berger and Boone. I'm Nancy Fitzpatrick, Administrator for the Oregon Salmon Commission, and this is Carl Finley, one of our new commissioners this year. I would like to just give a brief history of how we came to where we are. Back in November of 2005, the Salmon Commission held three meetings up the coast and down in Garibaldi, Newport, and Coos Bay to talk about limited entry and to talk about the lottery. And through those three meetings, there were concerns and discussions about where the industry needed to be. And then in February 28th, after the Salmon Industry Group meeting, the Salmon Commission had a meeting. We distributed a survey and received more input from the industry and had discussion at our Salmon Commission meeting and ultimately came up to the decision that we needed to reduce the 1,200 permits down to 1,000 by natural attrition, not cutting anyone out, but if someone does not renew their license, then that is gone, down to 1,000. And then another concern of the industry was as Roy and Kurt were saying, that we want to make sure that the salmon industry still remains an entry-level fishery to where anybody can get a permit, buy a small boat, and we can keep some of the younger members as fishermen in our industry. And so to help maintain that, we put in the division for the lottery. Currently, any boat, if 12 permits do not get renewed, then those 12 permits go into a lottery, and any vessel of any size can attain those through the lottery. The commission and the industry decided to help maintain the size, fleet size. We wanted to make sure that if a small boat goes out and does not renew their permit, then a small boat must come in its place. So that's why you see the divisions of the vessel size.
Madam Chair,
yes,
the question I wanted to ask earlier fits right now.
Yes.
Does that preclude someone buying a permit from someone else before they let it go?
No, they can still do any purchasing that is allowed by
So if a person wants to get out of the fishing business, he can sell his permit to someone else, and then that can be renewed.
This is just for if a fisherman does not renew his license at the end of the year.
What does that do to the cost of permits? Do people bid them up? If someone really wants a permit and someone has one for sale, they can charge whatever the market will bear.
Exactly.
Oh, okay.
Exactly.
Right. Just like basketball tickets.
Senator Morissette, one of the problems with the lottery as it exists is it tends to undercut this standard market in the licenses.
Senator Johnson?
Two questions now that we've taken this little break. How long in normal attrition do you think it's going to take for some of those permits to roll over?
I would have to defer to ODF&W. Are they still here, Kurt?
Mm-hmm. They are.
Okay, so that's question number one. Question number two is it's an entry-level fishery as long as you win the lottery.
Well, if a small boat goes out, then a small boat needs to come in its place.
Right, but if you've got one spot and six boats, they're going to... Five disappointed people are going to go home.
Well, that's the way it is in the lottery as it currently stands now. Also, yes.
Well, Representative Shaw.
If I own a small boat permit and I want to sell it, can I sell it to somebody with a big boat or the other way around?
It's within the range. Again, I'll 30 to below 30 foot, 30 to 42, and I think there's a 5 foot over.
I get it. I understand. Thank you very much.
Okay. So the Salmon Commission came up with the parts that you see of the bill, and we worked with ODF&W, and that's where we are right now. And so this is something that the industry is supporting, and we would like that to go forward. And I do want to thank Roy and Kurt for doing a wonderful synopsis that they did to make my job easier. and would like to thank you for this opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Nancy. Mr. Finnis.
Well, I'd just like to point out that...
If you'll introduce yourself.
I'm sorry, I'm Carl Finley, Madam Chair. I'd like to point out that... well, it doesn't matter.
You sure?
Well,
it's a wise man. He's winning, he's not...
We got enough said already.
Well, we'd be happy to hear your testimony.
No.
All right, Madam Chair. Kurt, if you'll come forward and answer Senator Johnson's question before I take the motion from Representative North.
And then Senator George.
Oh, and Senator George, okay.
And Senator Johnson's question was with regard to the entry level?
With regard to attrition.
Oh, thank you. Madam Co-Chairs, it's a little difficult for us to predict, but... in recent years, we've been losing about 10 to 12 permit renewals a year. Last year, however, we lost about 50 because there was so little salmon fishing opportunity. Many non-residents, frankly, that had higher fees on their vessels did not renew last year. So right now, we're at 1,129. My expectation is it's going to take several years, perhaps quite a few greater than five before we'd ever get down to that 1,000 number.
One follow-up? For the people that did not renew their permit, that permit is gone. They're not in some holding area where they can come back in with preferential treatment. They're just gone.
Madam Co-Chair, Senator Johnson, that's correct. They are gone. There are out of those, for instance, 50 that did not renew last year, there are, I think, three that are in appeals. And so they can go through the Commercial Fishery Permit Review Board and appeal their ability to renew the permit.
Some extenuating circumstances
exactly.
that cost them.
But it's a very small number that are in that process right now.
Thank you.
Senator George.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The bill concerns me on the front of we have a controlled market of 1,200 permits, and of course the industry is going to want us to cut it back to 1,000. So what kind of inflation are we talking about on the value of these permits because of the fact that we're taking it from 1,200 to 1,000 and then breaking it into these individual categories? It seems like this could have a dramatic upcharge on the value of these permits, and that concerns me because I'm not sure exactly. I mean, there's no constituency out there of people who want future permits. Do you see what I'm saying? So could you give me an idea of what we're talking about, the cost of permits, and then any idea of the impact of reducing it to 1,000 and then breaking it into these different categories? Because that could have a dramatic impact. I don't care who answers it. Just
Senator George, all right. Right now, typically, in a typical year as of late, we've had around 1,100 licenses. Well, only five or 600 of those licenses even go out and land one fish. And basically, 250 to 300 boats land 90% of the fish. There are 500 or 600 very altruistic people that are paying $275 a year to hold a salmon license for no apparent reason. But the point is that there's a lot of a slush here to be taken up, is the point I'm trying to make when it comes to this situation. There's so many licenses aren't fishing right now.
If I could follow up, Madam Chair.
I
guess what really gets me is I understand that because I looked at the statistics that were provided by the ODF&W, but when we break it into the categories of the different size fishing vessels, I really look at the vessels greater than 42 feet, for instance, are probably the ones that produce the large percentage of the catch. And all I'm trying to do is we're basically creating ourselves an artificial market for these narrow and fewer larger sheet vessel or maybe a mid vessel, whatever. And it seems like to me that we could be putting ourselves in a situation where, of course, the industry is advocating for it because it runs up the price of a permit in a specific size. And I guess there's a great deal of concern on my part that that may not be the best public policy. And maybe somebody can explain to me why it's good that way.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator George, just want to clarify the size categories are currently in statute, and all this bill is proposing to do is if there's a lottery to issue more permits, they have to be issued onto a vessel in the given size category from which the permit was lost. So for instance, in the last 5 years, we did hold some lotteries in the early 2000s, and for instance, a 20-foot vessel maybe did not renew their permit. They were in the small boat category that was already in an existing statute. Under the current provisions, any vessel could qualify for that. So there were large boats that were qualifying for what essentially came off of the permit that essentially came off of a small vessel. With regard to the value of these permits, they do, as was discussed here, they do have value. They're traded similar to a commodity. There's brokers out there that actually will broker your permit as well as vessels for you. We've seen over the last 7 to 10 years, the permit values, even though the number of renewals have been stable, the permit values have also been relatively stable. Small vessel permits trade for about $4,000. That's just the permit, no vessel or anything attached with it. Larger vessel permits have traded for some in excess of $10,000. That value has not changed much. And while there has to be some impact on permit values because you're reducing some from the pool at large, there's still a large, as Mr. Finley pointed out, there is still a large pool of available permits that are not actively fished.
I'm going to have to interrupt.
Thank you.
In the essence of time, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3541, and I'm going to open the work session on House Bill 3541 and recognize Representative Nelson.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 3541 to the House floor with a new pass recommendation.
Representative Nelson moves House Bill 3541 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? I'll ask the clerk to call the roll.
Senator George Hill?
Nope.
Senator Johnson?
Yes.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Senator Morissette?
Aye.
Representative Shoffler?
Aye.
Representative Collins?
Aye.
Senator George G.
Aye.
Representative Nelson?
All right. The House Bill 3541, having the required number of votes, passes. And Representative Boone, would you like
to carry
the bill?
I'd love to carry it.
All right.
Yes.
Representative Boone will carry the bill. And I have one question, and that is to the House members, do you think this is going to be a regular thing?
It will be next Thursday.
Yes.
We already know next Thursday it is.
It's
scheduled at 4:30. For some reason,
cooperates or not.
All right. We are adjourned.